then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's June the 4th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, we'll begin with a housekeeping note. Now, I've been discussing our plans for a call-in show on the Northwest Revolution email list, so I figure I owe you guys an update on that. Now, right now, we're waiting on a kind of harmonic convergence of time for myself and a co-host, plus the installation of certain technology, which we've got, we just need to get it up and running. And finally, we'll need a kind of training session with myself and the co-host, whoever he or she may be, to make sure that we know how to use the equipment and that everything works, including a couple of practice calls. Now, this will at some point involve the ultimate horror of someone attempting to teach Harold new software. The first few shows will not be live, so we can edit the file before uploading it and get rid of any glitches, all the e's and the uhs and the you knows and stuttering and lip smacking, and so we can deep six any idiots who get through, since at first we won't have any proper call screening. Any niggers or goat dancers who do get through will simply be hung up on, and no one will ever know they called because they'll be edited out. Once we get the drill for these pre-recorded shows down and get a little more comfortable with the gear and the format, we may try some live shows, either on our own or through a podcasting service, but that's a little too far down the pike right now to talk about. I do not want to promise you guys anything we can't deliver. I'm thinking we may attempt our first call-in maybe next week, probably on a Thursday, and those of you on the Northwest Revolution email list will be notified of the time. I'm still a little undecided about that, the main question being, do we want to be more accommodating to our people on the East Coast or the West Coast? And I'm starting to think that we may have to stagger the times each show to give our people in all four time zones a shot at getting home from work and being able to call in without staying up until midnight. I'll keep you guys advised on that by email. Okay, next topic. I got a more or less heckle on the Homeland blog about my use of the term Optimates. I can't even remember who posted it, as I recall some guy I don't know, with the usual trollish motivation of trying to show the world how clever he is, but since he was actually making a semi-legitimate point, I let him through this time. For those of you who came in late, I have been using the old Roman political term optimates to describe the so-called good people in the white nationalist movement, the people with skills and assets and a solid work history and a record of success out there in the real world. The guys who still have good jobs and actual mortgaged houses instead of cheesy apartments or double wides or renter houses at best, like, frankly, the majority of our people are forced to live in now. I especially use it to refer to the so-called good people among us who will not step forward and take up the burden of racial duty, which is why, for the past 50 years, the movement keeps ending up with the kind of unsuitable characters and dysfunctional people who have so completely screwed our pooch. Because at the end of the day, us fearless leader types have to take anyone we can get who will step forward and help, even if it risks public identification and exposure. The Latin word optimate means best people or good people, and I won't go into the long history of the term and the civil war between the optimates and the populares, which eventually resulted in the Roman Republic becoming an empire ruled by a monarch, so both sides lost. I won't get into this any further except to say that I'm well aware that there are many of you who are unwilling to lose what this society has granted you by way of home and family and possessions and wealth on a gamble for a new country and a new future that may not work out, and which may end with you having to forfeit your stake to the house, so to speak. I can't tell you that risk doesn't exist. It does. I can only take what you give me and do what I can with it, and hope that with that small trickle of help, I can eventually reduce the odds to something a little more encouraging. But we're not talking about the people here, we're talking about the word itself. Now, the heckler's point was that I should stop trying to import fancy foreign terminology. In this case, my use of the word optimates, because A, it's foreign, and everybody knows all that foreign shit ain't American. And B, the word sounds funny, and white Americans are too stupid to understand what I'm talking about and the history behind the word. And yeah, this guy does have something of a point. He's right. Sometimes I do try to mold thought processes and stimulate the vestigial remains of the white man's inquiring mind by historical digressions. And I do try to channel the sludge trough that is the collective white racial mind through the use of words in a somewhat Orwellian parameter-seizing way. And you know, like the United States government, the old press and intelligentsia, and the new media have been doing for the past 100 years. It's true that I do periodically try to counteract and undo a little of the damage by introducing new words into the discourse, and seeing if through using those words myself, I can make the fad catch on and thus alter the flow of the sludge in a more constructive racial direction, so to speak. My greatest success, of course, is introducing the word monkoids back in the early 70s through the White Power newspaper and my White Power hotline recordings from Arlington. I kept it up when I was with the NSPA in Chicago and Raleigh, and within our small little community at least, it seems to have stuck, finally. Just like my old Rhodesian buddy Eric Campbell invented the term Zog. Now, since the English language contains over 100 words for nigger, if one allows foreign words like kefir and melanzana, which is the Italian word for eggplant, that have entered English usage, I don't really consider monkoids to be much of an accomplishment. I'm not having quite so much success with another one of my attempts, at least not so far, which is to apply the word muggles to non-racially aware white people like the non-magical people in the Harry Potter books. Now, being racially aware of who you are and what is really going on around you is kind of like having magical powers. It really does set you apart from the run-of-the-mill pale faces on the street and the Walmart or the Tesco. You have something that they don't, and yes, I admit it. I flat-out plagiarized that. No apologies. I'll nick anything off anybody that looks like it might be serviceable to advance the 14 words. I even had my Northwest Volunteers in a mighty fortress rolling towards the Battle of Portland with the Jefferson Airplane song Volunteers blaring off the speakers of their trucks. Now, getting back to my heckler, though, he may have a point, and it could be that the term optimates is in fact too obscure and too esoteric for the average brain-dead honky mind ever to internalize. I'll give it some more time, but frankly, that one might not catch on. I see some signs that using the word muggle to describe the great unenlightened American dumbass is catching on. We'll see how that plays out. Now, there's a related topic I want to talk to you guys about and get your reaction on something. I've been complaining on here that we need to identify and start using a term for the enemy other than lefty lib, which is what I've been using, because I think that's too vague. I know most of us just say the Jews, but that's not completely accurate. Okay. In a way, it is, if you accept, as I do, something that the late, great Pastor Robert Miles once told me. He said something that impressed me greatly because it suddenly hit me when I heard it that it was true. Bob said that Judaism and Jewishness are not just a religion and not just a race. Judaism is a state of mind. It is the exaltation of pure materialism, devoid of any human spiritual element or any sense of human worth. He told me once, and I found it to be true, that some of the worst and most obnoxious and poisonous Jews I ever met wouldn't have a drop of Hebrew blood in their veins, and he was right. But of course, all this is too arcane and complicated to get Joe Sixpack and Jane Clueless to wrap their minds around. Remember, with white people today, you cannot confront them with any symbol or idea or slogan that you have to stop and explain, because then you've lost them. Now, this was one of the guy's complaints about my use of the word optimates. By the same token, I'd love to adopt the Irish words Sinn Féin for our movement because it says it all, ourselves alone. It is both a name for a movement and a slogan. But Americans wouldn't get it. We'd have to present long and detailed explanations to people with the historical awareness and the attention spans of houseflies. Our British comrades would get all upset because of the IRA connotation, not understanding just how completely different things are over here. It would cause all kinds of confusion, and it would just fizzle. Optimates may have a better chance of making it because that's purely an internal movement term that would only be used by a small number of people in the know, so to speak. Now, in a bit, you'll hear again from the English kid who wants to call them Bolshevists. I've got a lot of time for this young man because of his courage in speaking out publicly in the face of tyranny and risking prison, simply for having ideas that his government disagrees with. But as for getting 21st century people anywhere to run around using not just an obscure word that's hardly remembered anymore in popular culture today, but an even more obscure, anglicized variant of that word, well, lots of luck with that, mate. Anyway, the other day it suddenly came to me that we already have an ideal name for our enemy, one that is known worldwide, one that is accurate and all-encompassing and stark in its probity, a name that I have in fact already used in the Northwest novels and occasionally on here. The thing is, I'm not sure we're going to be able to sell it to what Rush Limbaugh calls the low-information voters, at least not for general usage. Low-information voters, by the way, is a polite term for pale dumbasses with nothing but pork fat between their ears, who are so stupid they actually believe what the Democrats and the ruling party's media tell them. And no, I'm not saying call the enemy Democrats, although I've done that before, and although that term would in fact be topically accurate in multiple ways in most American situations. But that would generate immediate screams that the Republicans are no better, which granted, they're not. Don't worry, guys, I haven't forgotten Jug Ears Bush and his Patriot Act or his Military Commissions Act of 2006. Anyway, the collective name I suggest we try to begin applying to our enemy, slowly and carefully, with large spoonfuls of sugar to help the bitter medicine go down and let it seep slowly into the skulls full of mush, is just this. America. Americans. Don't say the Jews have dumbed down our kids' minds, as true as that may be in many respects. Say America has dumbed down our kids' minds. Don't say the Jews sent us to war in the Middle East for Israel, although they certainly did. Say the Americans sent us to war in the Middle East to save Israel, because the Jews on their own have never been able to do doodly squat without the active consent and enthusiastic participation of the government of the United States. Remember all those Jews who don't have a drop of Hebrew blood in their veins that Bob Miles warned us about? Who do you think controls the United States government? All the other lefty lib causes, from buggery to affirmative action, from NSA spying to open borders, are all part of a Jewish agenda, true, very true, but a Jewish agenda implemented by the United States government and by huge sectors of the media, the private sector, the educational world, and the massive bureaucracy, most of whom, I'm sorry to have to say, are white-ish. Now, you want to know who's killing us in one simple word that covers the most ground? America is killing us. That's why we need a new country to survive in. Not America. Well, what do you think? I've run that one up the flagpole. Anybody saluting?
We're bound to die, 18 wheels are rolling. Are we going to do what they say can be done? We've got a long way to go, and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. If you put hard on the pedal, some never mind it breaks. Let it all hang out, cause we gotta run to make.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Nebraska. I'm on my way to California with a load. And I wanted to touch a little bit about safety on the road. Whether you're migrating or going on a weekend camping trip, or like this poor individual I saw this morning was dragging his boat through a road construction zone and tried to change lanes, and they had uneven pavement because they were re-blacktopping the road there on I-80 on the westbound side in Nebraska. And yeah, he caught the lip, and the trailer caught a different lip, and the tail wagged the dog, and the tail flipped the dog, and him, his SUV, and his boat ended up on the roof in the median. So, all you weekend commandos that are out there dragging trailers around, you need to be extra careful because you're not doing this all the time. And you hit uneven road surfaces like that, and yeah, bad things can happen. And a couple hours after that, I saw a professional driver, a grain wagon. I don't know what happened. He did keep it upright, but he ended up in the median, buried up to his axles in the mud. Yep, it can happen to just about anybody, so please, be cautious out there. If you're making your migration, you're going to be hauling a lot more weight than you normally would around, whether it be driving something you're not used to driving, like a U-Haul, pulling a car trailer or towing your trailer or car on a tow dolly, whichever. Yeah, it's something you're not normally used to doing, so please be extra cautious out there. Even if you're just going on a weekend camping trip or down to the lake with your boat, you never know what's going to happen. All right, well, this is the trucker signing off with another little tidbits from the road. Take it easy, comrades, and hope to see you out here in the homeland soon. Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Wyoming, the fictional homeland, or fictional part of the homeland. And you may think this is a slight exaggeration, but it's not. Trucking westbound across I-80. Just went through Laramie. And for those of you that are from the congested, smog-ridden eastern coast or eastern parts of the states, you may think I'm exaggerating. I'm BSing you, but this is no kidding. On a nice clear day, like it is today, on the 30th of May, the visibility is like 50, 60 or more miles, and I'm surrounded by eastern guardians of the homeland, the Rockies, and it's just a breathtaking sight to see, not being surrounded by your teeming masses over there on the East Coast or other metropolitan areas of the United States. This is so nice just to be out here in the middle of nowhere. It's little light puffy clouds up there, basically unlimited visibility. It is just clear as a bell here, and it's just spectacular to see. Granted, this is a fictional part of the homeland from the books, but still, it's the same thing over there in the homeland, unless you get around Seattle or something like that. But even there, I mean, you can see Mount Rainier from Seattle or Bremerton. You can see the Olympic Peninsula mountains over there, the Olympics, from Seattle on a nice clear day. It's not like when I go back east and stuff, surrounded by the masses. I can just, it's just so nice and gorgeous here. I don't know why you're staying there. At least make a scouting trip out here and then tell me I'm lying. All right, this is the trucker signing off from Wyoming. Hope to see you out here in the homeland soon, comrades.
This is the opening theme song from the television series about World War II, The Pacific. I've often thought it would make a good opening for the first serious documentary about the Northwest War of Independence. Thank you.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be talking about William Simpson and his book Towards the Rising Sun. This is also the author of Which Way, Western Man. William was born in 1892. His background was predominantly Irish on both sides, and his family life tended to center around the Protestant church. He ended up going to Lafayette College, and he turned out to be very academic. Now, while he was there, he started to develop very unorthodox views about Christianity and specifically about Jesus. Despite his parents' objections, he decides that he wants to attend Union Theological Seminary. Now, this was considered to be very much a hotbed of heresy, but in 1915 he graduates. And upon graduating, he chooses a life of hardship by serving in a pauper's church. Now, already, he tends towards socialism, so much so that he is disliked by factory owners. He was very much against the First World War, and even church members found him to be too progressive. Now, at one point, the Department of Justice actually warned him to stop preaching, and by 1918, he had resigned from the church. He wrote an essay explaining that the church was about money and power, and he also felt that the church had promoted the First World War. After that, for 1 year, he became associate director of what would later become the ACLU. And around this time, he decides to study the life of St. Francis. So he quits his job in order to live in poverty or something close to poverty. Now, he decides that he really wants to be a revolutionary organizer or at least an agitator. His ultimate desire was to overthrow capitalism. So he goes out to support himself as a manual laborer to learn about the oppressed. Now, at this point, he realizes that individuals need to improve themselves. It's not just about changing the system. So at this point, he goes a little more mainstream, and he takes a teaching job at a radical and idealistic school. But later on, he learns that the school was supported by exploited workers. So he declines an offer for the headmaster position and just resigns. In 1920, he decides that he wants to move to a foreign working-class neighborhood, and he gives away a lot of his possessions. He works as a carpenter and preaches in the street. From time to time, he gets arrested. Now, he does this for 9 years. And after that, he's getting a little older now, and he finds that it's catching up to him in terms of his health. His friends get together and they decide they're going to fund a world tour on his behalf, and he considers going to meet Gandhi. Now, he goes on this world tour, decides he isn't going to meet Gandhi. He decides that all is within him. He decides that he wants to return home and he wants to get married. So he gets married and has a son. Now, in some sense, this might seem a little selfish because eventually he decides that he's going to leave his family and he's going to return to India. During this second trip to India, he suddenly realizes he's not called to poverty. He sees no point in lying in gutters with the poor. Now, he returns home to America. He starts questioning a lot of things. He questions the existence of God, a moral order, mythical experience, the idea of living in poverty, nonviolence, democracy, equality. He's questioning everything. He starts to study Nietzsche, but also Thoreau and Whitman and Blake. And in the fall of 1933, he starts speaking to young people as a seeker of truth and not as a social worker or as a reformer. So he basically rehashes this tale of how he spent many years seeking social goodness in some sense and how he became tired of this. And he starts talking about how he's going to preach rare music to rare ears. and he's seeking something that is at the expense of orthodoxy, virtue, or career. And he recommends moderate poverty. He talks about the family, how that can be an obstacle. Sometimes it's because of concern for parents, because some parents will raise their children to be rather dependent. Or he talks also of marriage, the responsibility of marriage, and advises marriage only if a spouse supports your vision. And of course, this advice is directed at people who have this overriding and insatiable vision. Now, he talks about this notion of the truth, and as a philosopher, he places truth over effectiveness. He's not so much interested in the truth as a series of facts, but as a vision-based concept. He says that while most people really ought to resist evil, the visionary should not resist it. Also, the visionary should not be merely in negative opposition to something. Now, back in the 20s, I suppose a prohibitionist might be an example of someone who is primarily in a negative opposition. But the focus should be on what he calls dreams, or following the higher self. Now, while he speaks much of a visionary who uses reason, he also sees this visionary as being primarily intuitive. And as an intellectual, he acknowledges that others have been on the path before, so of course consult them, but don't live according to abstract ideals. Now, he recommends stillness, which sounds a lot like meditation to me, and he makes a final analogy of a fire kindled by sticks, and speaks of an untamed warrior of divine impatience. In his final essay, he states the necessity of real personal and direct sacrifices for those chosen for this mission. Now, essentially, this is a transcendentalist work. You can see the Whitman and the Thoreau in it, and you can see also the influence of Nietzsche. Now, this is a very safe book, and indeed I found myself double-checking. Did I purchase the correct book? Because while it may allude to the struggle, it's general enough that if you slipped it into a high school transcendentalism unit that an English class was working on, for example, would anyone notice? Clearly, this is a first effort or a record of being on the edge of things. Next week, I'm going to discuss Which Way, Western Man. I certainly would recommend this book for those in need.
And if I might interject here once more, that brutal and ruthless Nazi efficiency, which once made us the terror of the civilized world, has come into play. Either Gretchen or myself accidentally cut off the last few seconds of this submission of hers. I'll go ahead and just assume it was me that did it. I don't know how, but sometimes I screw up in my editing. Anyway, I would like to apologize both to our listeners and to Gretchen herself if I caused this. But sometimes that's the way these things play out. Sorry about that, guys. This is the second part of a rather lengthy MP3 file that was sent to me by the British comrade who was on last week. As you can tell, he is apparently reading out loud a written article which I think he wrote himself, which is something I don't like to do much because often political polemic essays that were meant to be read in text form don't transmute all that well into the spoken word. But as I said before, no matter how this sounds to us, the important thing is that he is speaking out loud in public and risking prison in his own country for doing so. Now, this will lead into what I want to talk about in the third segment of the show.
The list goes on and on, but these are some of the main concerns for the average National Socialist. Many will, of course, disagree with this list. Naturally, disagreeing with one another has become a part of National Socialist movement in lieu of fighting our enemies. and smashing those who wish every single day for the elimination of our sacred, beautiful people. These movements are all unified under the Jews. Their specific focuses are irrelevant because they encompass the end goal of the Jews, and their first priority is always the elimination of the white race by any means. Homosexuality and feminism are deliberately pushed because they destroy white culture. They are incessantly driven into the minds of white people everywhere. Homosexuality among blacks is not pushed. Race mixing among blacks is not a focus. For example, and they do not care about whether or not the Hispanics or blacks or Muslims have issues with feminism. In most cases, these races smash feminism and homosexuality with an iron fist as we do. This applies especially to Islam, which, where traditional Islam is followed, puts a brutal and fitting end to any homosexuals. Though the element of feminism is arguably irrelevant, feminism as a concept does not exist in these nations, and if it did, it would be so brutally suppressed as to make even the most hardy Western Muslim lose faith in his home countries, which have already completely undermined the notion of peaceful or accepting Islam. Returning to the subject at hand, these movements are all a part of the Jewish plan to eliminate the white race. Thus, we can freely group them under one banner. This allows us to say the Bolshevik movement is at it again, and this time they are even more intensely pushing their pro-homosexual agenda at the cost of the white race. There will be those again who disagree with my suggestion that we should use Bolshevist, Bolshevik, and Bolshevism to describe this hated foe. I unwaveringly and unreservedly believe that this is the solution to our buzzword problem. It is in the spirit of National Socialism, in the spirit of the Kantite, that we recognize this foe under a single name and a single flag. For the Jews who established Bolshevism in the Führer's day are the same type who today promote so-called equal rights among men and women who practice such vile acts as to undermine any notion of lower life. Bolshevism, then, can quite accurately also be said to be a purely cancerous ideal in what it pushes. When the white man or woman is told what Bolshevism stands for, what it represents, and what, since the collapse of the USSR, it has taken on as part of its crude amalgamation of ideological principles, then they will cry out in anguish that such a threat exists and has not been stamped upon until death by the sheer might of the white folk and its armed forces. Once our great peoples realizes the seriousness of this threat, they will rise up in battle against the cursed foe and make him pay for what he has done. The heroic sacrifice of the Führer is not by any means an indication that National Socialism is finished, but rather that this war continues until the very last man and bullet. We will not be finished until the Bolshevik foe has been utterly reckoned with, until the last Bolshevist has been without mercy slaughtered. Only then may we lay wreath and bow on the graves of the fallen from two world wars, and ultimately one race war, with the inscription, "And you still were victorious." 5. Identifying the foe. What constitutes a Bolshevik, and how can you identify him or her for what and who they are accurately? Put in its most base form, the Bolshevik is anyone who promotes and pushes the list of ideals listed in Chapter 4. These individuals will be of a great plethora of types coming from all kinds of backgrounds. In many cases, they will only push for one or two of these ideals and may actually well disagree with the rest. At this point, many will of course say, but if they disagree with certain tenets of Bolshevism, how on earth can they be Bolshevist? Now your concept loses its relevance and is utterly pointless. They are going to find the suggestion laughable. To those people I say, we are not trying to satisfy them, we are trying to awaken our folk. The struggle is for the folk. It is not to name each and every single divergent Bolshevist movement. If one were to do that, it would take forever. Thereby, the umbrella term gives us everything we need. It is as simple as this. Person A follows X ideal. X ideal is part of the Jewish structure towards the elimination of the white race. Jewish structure is named Y. Thus, person A fits the criteria to be called Y, and in this case, Y is Bolshevism. X may be any of the ideals listed above in any number. If one cannot grasp this base concept, one refuses to recognize the dire need to adjust our position and to name our foes as the Führer would. 6. Conclusion. No matter how grave the crisis looks now, through our unalterable will and willingness for sacrifice, we will overcome the situation. Adolf Hitler, Führer und Reichskanzler, Oberbefehlshaber der Wehrmacht. It is impossible to imagine a world wherein our cause can succeed, as long as we are unable to master the present method the folk prefers to be convinced by, this of course being buzzwords, cheap and easy marketing of ideals, leaflets and notes that can be read in 15 seconds or less, short, concise advertisements and videos which promote the ideal without boring the viewer. That is the reason the left has been so successful. People do not want to watch long, lasting, but nonetheless hugely fulfilling videos such as The Greatest Story Never Told, because they no longer have the attention span to stay focused. They lose interest. They want something else, something quick that they can express around their friends and colleagues. This is a simple fact. The lowliest man of the working class, poverty-ridden, becomes a genius after reading, for example, Mein Kampf. But we can make him more intellectually aware by providing for him snippets of critical information quickly and with ease. This is what the modern Bolshevist does. It is how the modern Bolshevist wins, and it is how we are, to a degree, struggling. We cannot win if we do not learn how to adapt to our circumstances. Party leaflets have proven to be, in many cases, unsuccessful. Canvassing is a promising alternative, but whom among us is prepared to march from home to home, greeting our folk and telling them the harsh facts of life? Unless a movement is prepared to do this in cohesion with the same tactics that, for example, Britain First have been developing, then we will never succeed. Amusingly, there is a suggestion that Britain First are controlled opposition for the sheer success they have in their marketing techniques. Regardless, we must copy these tactics, starting with the name for our enemies, and that name is Bolshevik. His ideal is Bolshevism, and it encompasses all of X ideas, and more besides. 7. Note. 1. Introduction. Note 1. Under the Tsars, the Slavic people were noble Christian stock. The Führer would never have marched east had it not been for the enormous threat posed by the Bolshevik hordes. See Mein Kampf for reference. 3. Why Bolshevist? Note 1. Perhaps as much as 30 million killed by Lenin and Stalin, and between 24 to 31 million military and civilian casualties during the Second World War as a result of Bolshevik incompetence. It is arguable that Bolshevism is responsible for upwards of 60 million Slavic deaths. Thus, it is astonishing that they presently have a strong Communist Party in the Russian Federation today. Then again, the Jews must suffer serious headaches with such a degree of cognitive dissonance. Note 2. Nothing more than the slaveries of the Kims and their backward ideology. Note 3. An antique, wherein the population have become virtual slaves to a very tiny minority of hugely rich proto-state capitalist leaders. 4. Outward divisions, inward unity. Note 1. Do not mistake this for an agreement with Islam. Facts are facts, and we must recognize this. Islam and its adherents must be brutally forced back into the deserts. 7. Author's note. I hope this minuscule essay is of use to you out there who are struggling with the ideas of what to call our enemy. Many will disagree with my suggestion, as it is natural within the movement, and I recognize that there are some flaws to this proposal. Nonetheless, I feel that it is the best choice and has such meaning behind it as to bring our movement on a level with these successful leftist organizations who are so apt at convincing our youth to accept the degenerate ideals of Bolshevism. After making my point, I have referred to the ideals espoused by Bolshevists for what they are, Bolshevism, throughout the essay, so it may be difficult to differentiate. But then, my goal is to convince you that Bolshevism is the term we are using. Thus, I find it most amusing to consider you may be able to recognize that we can place today's Bolshevists on the same level as the Bolsheviks the Führer fought on the streets of Munich, in the sense that they are of the same mindset. On another note, Führer Prinzip, or simply FP, is my preferred pseudonym. Please feel free to distribute this work far and wide and to criticize it as you wish, though I must admit I see no reason to debate the subject any further personally. As always, action is required, not words. My writing style tends to be conversational, and thus may not be typical of academic pieces, is that you benefit from some of the ideas here, and are able to use them appropriately in real life. Thank you for listening.
In jeder Stunde, an jedem Tag, nur zu denken an Deutschland, an Volk und an Reich, an unsere deutsche Nation, unser deutsches Volk siegt Heil!
Well, we haven't had any militaria on here for a while, so this is a marching version of the old Boer folk song from South Africa, Sare Marae. It's kind of like their unofficial national anthem down there. Ironically, this is the band of the British Grenadier Guards. I mentioned at the beginning of the young English lad's speech that I intended to go into something special here in this segment of Radio Free Northwest, so here it is. As most of you know, for a period of some years, I myself lived in Europe, in England, and in Ireland, and in the Isle of Man. I lived there not as an American tourist, but like the local people live. And so for that reason, in addition to my knowledge of the history of our movement in Europe, I'm at least somewhat qualified, I think, to formulate an opinion on certain things European. Normally, I would not stick my big American nose into the political affairs of another country. But I was rather inspired by the young Englishman that we've had on last week and this week, and also the young Canadian last week, who dared to defy the Zionist occupational governments in their own lands and speak out loud, risking arrest and prison to do so. Now, for some time now, I've been toying with an idea that I think our European and Canadian comrades should consider. Since they seem intent on using only democracy to advance the racial cause in their countries, as futile as democracy has always proven, this would be an ideal technique for them to adopt, I think. But especially in the English-speaking world, Great Britain and Ireland and Canada and Australia. First, another one of Harold's interminable historical lessons, this time from the history of Ireland in the early 19th century. Now, some of you may know something about the 18th and 19th century penal laws in Ireland, when Roman Catholics were forbidden to vote or to hold public office, forbidden to own land worth more than a set amount, forbidden to own a horse worth more than £5 or any firearm at all, forbidden to pass on their property to a single heir, but were forced to divide it equally among all their children so that Catholic families could never accumulate any inherited wealth, etc., etc. Now, the parallels between that time and the situation of white nationalists and national socialists in Europe today are chillingly similar. White people are being persecuted for what they believe and for who they are. So, how do the Irish fight against this tyranny other than by sporadic acts of basically vandalism like we get all over Europe today from young dispossessed white people that send them to prison all the time? The Irish, of course, fled the country on board the immigrant ships to America by the millions, but that isn't really an option for European nationalists anymore since Obama has only opened our borders here to unlimited immigration from people with skin the color of shit. White people still have to jump through all the hoops, and fewer make it into America every year. Okay, I'm not going to start off reading a history website to you guys on here. I'll just keep this simple and basic. You need to look up a guy named Daniel O'Connell, a lawyer in Dublin during the 1820s and 30s, who is regarded by scholars as the first modern Irish nationalist. Rather than encourage actual violent opposition to the penal laws against Catholics in ways that would get young Irishmen shot down or hanged by the British or transported to Australia in slave ships, in the 1830s, O'Connell decided to build a legal protest and action movement against the laws themselves, using democracy and the court system. It was the first of its kind in modern history. O'Connell actually predated Mahatma Gandhi by about 80 years. He founded something called the Repeal Association, with the stated object of repealing the penal laws against Roman Catholics through legislation in the British Parliament, where, if memory serves, he actually got himself elected, or maybe that was just Parnell, I can't remember. Anyway, although it took him years working within the system, Daniel O'Connell did manage to get the bulk of the Irish penal laws repealed. Not that that did them any good when the potato famine hit. And then O'Connell went for the big prize itself, actual political reform, trying to repeal the Act of Union between Ireland and Britain and re-establish a separate Irish Parliament in Dublin. And the British stomped on him for his trouble. Being a lawyer who believed in peace and the law, when they threatened O'Connell and his friends, O'Connell folded like a lawn chair, but that's another story. Now, you guys in Europe and Britain and Canada specifically, who are tired of beating your heads against the wall and doing periodic prison stretches for making an internet post that some British cop or Richard Warman doesn't like, may I suggest that you attempt seriously the following tactic. Number one, form a front group called the British or Canadian Repeal Association, not Free Speech Association or anything like that. That's too vague. You're not just agitating for free speech in general. You are seeking the repeal of certain specific laws of Parliament. Now, that will also establish a traditional connection to the past repeal movement in Ireland, which has politically correct chic, so you need to actually use the term repeal association, so you can claim Daniel O'Connell as a spiritual ancestor and mentor, that kind of thing. Drive the lefties nuts. Identify specifically which statutes on the books prevent white people from speaking or writing or posting on the internet freely about race or the Jews or the Holocaust or immigration or whatever. Now, the Race Relations Act or the Public Order Act in Britain sound like a good starting place to me. And whatever this new thingy is they've come up with that gives you 7 years instead of five. And also, whatever the actual statutory federal and provincial laws are in Canada, the laws establishing those obscene human rights tribunals, so forth and so on. That should be your first piece of literature, a pamphlet or a website, preferably both, listing your country's specific hate laws by chapter and verse, the ones that you are specifically targeting for repeal. Set your group or committee up formally. Register with the authorities as a political action committee or a lobbying group or whatever you have to do to operate openly and lawfully in politics in Britain or Canada. Everything must be completely open and above board. Make sure that your group's finances are in apple pie order. No national alliance or Nick Griffin-style fiddles. No Nick Griffin-style dodgy people involved insofar as that can ever be avoided in our movement. Every I dotted and every T crossed. Keep all necessary records up to date and squeaky clean because they will be coming after you with their police and prosecutors once you start having some effect. Then start lobbying like real lobbyists do. Every trick in their book except for outright bribery, which we won't have the money to do. Everything from letters to members of parliament, to letters to the editor, to YouTube presentations, websites, and forums, the zonks. All perfectly polite, perfectly civil, and respectful of our lords and masters. No N-words or J-words or F-words. That's important. In your political and propaganda work, never give in to the temptation to discuss the actual problem itself, niggas or immigrants or violent crime by niggas and immigrants or the Holocaust or whatever. To discuss such matters would be to violate the very laws that you are trying to repeal and would open you and your group to prosecution and banning. I make sure that all your people know this, and that in public you speak only about the laws themselves, making them the issue, making every legal and moral and social case you can make for the repeal of these laws and for true freedom of speech in Britain or Canada. Now, a good slogan might be, let the people speak. How can even the most deranged lefty-lib Labour Party Crown prosecutor claim that is hate speech? Now, this is what will hopefully keep you legal and out of prison. You are at all times respectfully and peacefully asking your lords and masters in Whitehall or in Ottawa for redress of grievances, as is your lawful right to do, or so they say. Now, like all the rights we supposedly have, once we try to use those rights, all of a sudden the situation gets dodgy. Now, don't worry, everyone you speak with will get the massive subtext underlying all of this. Eventually, media and parliamentary committees or whatever will demand of you why you are asking for the repeal of these particular laws. And when that happens, you smile courteously and say, I'm sorry, I can't tell you that. It would be against the law, which is precisely our entire point. Guys, do you see where I'm going with all this? Now, this is another one I've run up the flagpole. Any of you Brits and Canucks saluting out there? Okay, I know I probably play this one too often, but anytime it's anything to do with free speech, I just gotta. This is Makem and Clancy.
Enemies say nothing when you talk about you know what. Or if you know who should hear, you know what you'll get. It'll take you off to you know where, you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you sing it. Sing it away. And whatever you say nothing when you talk about you know what. For if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off to you know where, for you wouldn't know how long. So for you know whose sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. You all know what I'm speaking of when I mention you know what. And I fear it's very dangerous to even mention that. For the other ones are always near, although you may not see. And if anyone asks who told you that, please don't mention me. And whatever you say nothing when you talk about you know what. Or if you know who should hear, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off, you know where, for you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. You all know who I'm speaking of when I mention you know who. For if you know who should hear you, you know what he'd do. So if you don't see me again, you'll know why I'm away. And if anyone asks you where I've gone, here's what you must say. Whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, for if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off, you know where, for you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. Well, that's enough about so-and-so, not to mention such-and-such. And I better end my song, and I've already said too much. For the less you say and the less you hear, the less you'll go astray. The less you think and the less you do, the more you'll hear them say. Oh, whatever you say, say nothing. Come on, when you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off, you know where, but you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing a song. And whatever you say, say nothing, when you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off to you know where, for you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. And whatever you say, say nothing, when you talk about you know what. But if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off to you know where, for you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. For you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song.
Right, almost out of time, but before I go, I want to tack on one more little bit here. Now, J.P. Morgan once said, never apologize, never explain. Usually I follow that advice, but not this week. I'm not going to once again waste your time bitching about my increasing secretarial workload, because that increase is a good thing in that it indicates that we're beginning to grow as a movement. I'd be a lot more worried if I was still sitting around twiddling my thumbs like I was down in Astoria for so many years. Nor am I going to bitch and moan about my lack of an ideal assistant or the lack of a headquarters or any of my usual whines. The proper place for those is in the monthly organizational letters, out of earshot of our unpleasant neighbors who are listening over the back fence here. Now, what I do want to say is this. In the past year or so, there have been a growing number of contacts with you guys that have left me increasingly uneasy in that you have sent me long and serious letters and emails asking serious questions about serious things and raising vitally important issues, and you've gotten virtually no reply. At best, some of you have sent me letters and emails asking crucial and intricate questions or pouring out your souls to me about one thing or another, and you have gotten a postcard or a monosyllabic grunt by email in reply. Or no reply at all. Now, for what it is worth, I apologize for that. You who support this movement deserve individual attention. You deserve validation, and in many cases, you deserve long, detailed, and thoughtful responses to your communications. That kind of considered, well-thought-out, and carefully composed written response to people asking legitimate questions of me is the first thing that has gone out the window when things started to grow and time got tight, and for that, I'm truly sorry. Believe me, I would love to be like Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin or some other founding father, sitting at my elegant writing table of an evening in my wig and knee breeches and sipping a crystal glass of claret and composing long, elegant letters with a quill pen to John Hancock or Samuel Adams while a fire crackles merrily in the hearth. I can't do that. That's just not the way it's played out. You need to understand that now and for the foreseeable future, I am no longer a writer. It is entirely possible that I will never write again, because however much time I may have left is simply going to be taken up with other things. Right now, I'm basically a secretary who jabbers for a few minutes every week on the internet and spends the rest of his time maintaining and servicing lists of various kinds. Well, that's what happens when you try to shift from loosey-goosey, which is basically a tacit admission that white Americans of these past few generations are incapable of organizing anything or ever working together, and you try to shift from that into the Rotary Club template, which in its turn produces mess like the present National Alliance clusterfuck. Hobson's choice. But anyway, you have to play the cards you're dealt, and these are the cards we're being dealt. I'll continue to do the best I can with whatever you give me to work with. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha and Aman. Freedom.
Beating heart.